Hello, everyone. It's John Pollock, and today we are presenting you a preview of the new series that Neil Flanagan and I have launched called Book Club. This is an exclusive series that we have made available to Double Double and Espresso patrons up at postwrestlingcafe.com. We started back in February, and thus far we have gone 4 books deep into our series of reviews, starting off with There's Just One Problem by former lead WWE writer Brian Gewirtz, The Queen of the Ring by Jeff Lean, Hell in Boots, Clawing My Way Through 9 Lives by Soraya, and this month's edition is focusing on All the President's Men by Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward, covering the Watergate scandal in 1974. It's our first non-wrestling review, so we are going to be throwing out this half-hour preview of the show. If you are so inclined, feel free to jump on board the Post Wrestling Cafe at the Double Double or Espresso levels, where we put this show out monthly. In June, we're going to be reviewing Under the Black Hat, which is the second biography by Jim Ross, along with co-writer Paul O'Brien. So here it is, Neil Flanagan and I chatting All the President's Men. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the May edition of Book Club. Here we are for our Double Double and Espresso members, and it is the busiest man at Post Wrestling this week, Neil Flanagan. I mean, this guy, not only reading books, providing his wisdom on the wellness policy, is going to sit back for a cool 3 hours of SmackDown, and the man has time for coffee dates. I mean, the busiest man that I know, Neil Flanagan. How are you doing, Neil?
Quite the intro, John, and shucks. But at the same time, the wellness policy was me just more or less opening my personal life to our listeners. So there wasn't much prep or effort really needed there. Just some probing from the other two guys, you know, asking me a few questions.
Is that daunting? Is that, are you comfortable chatting about that aspect of your life on a public forum?
I'm fine talking about things like that. As long as if the people I'm talking to are people I'm friendly and comfortable with. Now, as Way pointed out, then it's like, it's out there on YouTube, but I don't care. You know, at this point in my life, I don't sound like a 90-year-old, but like, you know, I've always been the sort of person who puts their real photograph and real name on social media and stuff like that. I don't really have any alter egos going around here, so I don't care.
Are you trying to tell us you're an open book?
Ah, what a transition. Let's go.
Well, we are going to be getting political on this particular edition of Book Club. I'm looking forward to discussing this month's selection that Neil made, and I was more than intrigued to reread this book. It's been several years since I've read our particular subject matter, but we're going to go in reverse this month. I wanted to ask you, Neil, what other than any Bernstein and Woodward releases from 1974? Have you been reading of late? Any books that are on the go or ones that you maybe have your eye on for the future?
Hilariously, not a Bernstein and Woodward book from 1974, but I jumped straight into The Final Days, which is the follow-up to this book, because I'm now in a Watergate Nixon scandal rabbit hole. I've been watching YouTube videos, interviews with Woodward and Bernstein, interviews with Robert Redford, who maybe get into this as we get into the review, but whose early involvement in all of this I was entirely unaware of, although I had seen the film. I didn't know how early in the process that Robert Redford had been in touch with these reporters. So it's not so much what I'm reading is the follow-up to this book, which sort of outlines less of the legwork of reporting that Woodward and Bernstein did. They had really opened the door for what came next, which was, prosecutions, impeachment hearings, the release of Nixon's tapes, all of that, and his resignation. They're not covered in All the President's Men. It sort of finishes, and they didn't know this, it sort of finishes with Nixon vowing not to resign. They didn't know this when it went to publication that it would happen. So yes, that's what I've been reading.
Yeah, there's so much you can go down, and I'm sure we'll get into it more with All the President's Men. After reading this, what's been on my reading list of late? I'm reading this one book. It's called Black Wall Street: From Riot to Renaissance in Tulsa's Historic Greenwood District, and this is about the Tulsa race massacre that occurred in 1921, and it's sort of just an overview of how this was this horrific 24-hour period of which, you know, this black man was accused of assaulting a woman, and it was, he was essentially just targeted here with this accusation, and it led to this horrific massacre in Tulsa and all of these deaths that occurred. And it's not just the 24-hour period, but how it's contextualized in history for decades to come. Like, this was not being taught in schools. And, you know, up until I would say, like, I remember, like, myself only hearing about this, like, in the wake of, like, the George Floyd murder. Like, this is this horrific moment in American history that is often not, this is not something that is overly remembered or talked about, including in schools. And, you know, sadly, I'm reading this book, which was, you know, written many, many years ago, and kind of this idea of evolving this and getting this out there. And unfortunately, with the current way that the education department is going into the U.S., it seems like there's going to be less and less of this kind of history being taught. So there is some connection to the current state of things. So it's a bit of a heavier read. I also have bought the on the wrestling front, this new book that Kevin Owens just promoted about himself and his feud with Sami Zayn, that we're actually going to have an interview with the author coming up on the site in the coming days as well. So you can look out for that. It's basically a history of Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn going through most of their big matches together. It's not like a biography of the two, but rather their chemistry on camera and how these two have been so intertwined throughout the past, really going back to like 2002 when they first met. So it's quite an interesting story when you look at these two and where they have gone from wrestling in bars in Montreal to right to the top of WrestleMania and, you know, at the Rogers Center this past February as well for the Elimination Chamber show. So it's a really interesting book, and it's put out by this group called Hybrid Shoot that Jonathan Snowden started. And it's just working with a lot of like authors to put out wrestling and MMA books and such. So it's a grind to try and be in that kind of business. So I think that it's, I think it meant a lot to them to get that big plug from Kevin Owens earlier this week.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I believe the author, was behind the account MythGifts on Twitter, as was. And, it was an account that I followed because this person had, clearly was a big fan and follower of both wrestlers and sort of contextualized a lot in those tweets. So a very interesting account. And, I did notice that, in his recent injury update, which is that he hasn't had surgery yet, he's still working out what to do, that he promoted this. And I was intrigued myself, I have to say. So yeah, very interested in reading this.
One other recommendation I'm going to throw out, non-book related, but podcast related. I'm sure many people have heard of Freakonomics, very popular podcast. Mm-hmm. They have just recently put out, I think it's a re-release with some updates to it. It's a four-part series called How to Succeed at Failing. It's amazing. It's dissecting how we as a culture take failure and such an aversion to acknowledging failure. What are the benefits of failure? Like, if you are going to put so much work into something and you're routinely coming up short on something, when does that inform you to move on to something else that you might be more, you may have a greater contribution both to society at large and yourself personally, and where failure can teach, and why we don't place more of a focus on failure. And it looks at all these things from, you know, failure in the medical industry that can mean life or death, failure within education, failure within your romance with others. It's a really fascinating series. I've listened to three episodes. I haven't heard the fourth one yet. The third one, which is called Grit or Quit, it's my favorite one. It's really, really good. So if you're a fan of the Freakonomics and their style, or even if not, it's kind of a good sample of what they do, like taking a subject and really going in deep on it. So if you're up for failure, a great listen. So it was right up my alley, Neil.
Excellent. No, it's this man, best recommendations. I'd certainly be checking that one out.
But today we're here to talk about all the president's men. Look at this. Look at this. The actual copy here we have from Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward covering the Watergate scandal. Neil, when did you first become aware of what Watergate was?
At school. It was taught to us in history for In our fifth year, see, I don't know how to translate our school system into the grade system over in the US and
this
Canada.
This is high school or is this pre-high school?
Secondary school. So, my fifth year of that. So I'm, 16 at the time.
Okay.
Yeah. So we've got two more years of school to go. And I'm studying at that point. We do exams called GCSEs, General Certificate of Secondary Education, and, history. Had an American history counterpart, and it was generally the modern era. And we went right up to Nixon. And this is what I was most fascinated by at that time. Then when journalism was a career interest of mine, I saw as part of our course, they showed All the President's Men, the movie, which I loved, and even then it was sort of quaint, the typewriters, the leaning on the phone all the entire time, all of that kind of stuff. But I had never read the book until just recently. When I thought, I really want to read this book. It's been on my to-do list for at this point, I don't know how many years. So let's suggest it to John and see what he makes of it.
I was like racking my brain. Like, when would I first been aware of Watergate? And the answer I came to would have probably when I was like 10 or 11 years old. And the scene in Forrest Gump, where Forrest Gump sees somebody like with a flashlight at the Watergate Hotel, and he calls someone's power is out or something like that. And I probably had no idea of what the significance of that scene was when I was 11. But I can't even remember being taught this in school, which is, in Canada, we learned some U.S. history, but probably not as in depth as, you could have gone. But I've always been fascinated with like American politics. So Watergate, I mean, it's not this would probably, if you were asked someone, what is the most famous political scandal that you've ever heard of? Watergate is probably going to, that's the guess you're making on Family Feud for sure.
And the gate, of course, oh, God.
I hate blank gate that is attached to it. To me, it's so lazy. And it's just, I guess it's a throwback to, it's just it's constantly brought up in every scandal thereafter, but I guess that is part of the legacy of it all.
Collision Gate last Saturday.
Yes, TNT Gate, all of those. So in the lead up to this, I read the book, and then this past weekend I also rewatched the movie, which it's a really excellent movie. And sometimes you will read a book and then watch the movie, and I mean, for me personally, the movie usually comes up short. This is one. It's pretty, I mean, granted, we're in the 70s. It's a book about journalism that I think there was an onus for the movie to be pretty, like, the real story is fascinating as it is. It didn't need embellishment or anything. I mean, they certainly present Deep Throat, I mean, as kind of the one scene where, Robert Redford's character, he's playing Bob Woodward, turns around, he hears something, and then poof, Deep Throat has disappeared like Batman. Yeah, like Batman. I mean, that's maybe the most silliest scene in the movie, but it's pretty accurate in terms of taking the source material into the film. Like, to me, it's one of my favorite movies. It's a very easily rewatchable movie if this is the kind of if you're into the topic.
It's a fantastic film. And having rewatched it very recently, to anyone who really doesn't feel they have time to read the book, watch the movie if you can. I haven't been able to find it on streaming services, unfortunately, but it was for sale for $3.99 on Apple, sort of what they used to call iTunes. Apple TV, still sells things. And I could rent it for $3.50 or buy it for $3.99. So that wasn't a hard calculation to make, because I'll probably watch it again at some point. I like the way they do compress things together. The librarian incident is sort of compressed into one phone call where she says, "Oh yes, I remember, books on Chappaquiddick being taken out." And then comes back onto the phone while, Bernstein's on hold to say, "Sorry, I made a mistake. Actually, that unfolded over several days and he had a lot more." But the spirit of the facts, really, it is pretty faithful to the real story.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths and sometimes heights to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to arrow hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.
Let's talk let's assume some people are listening to this and they've heard the term Watergate, but they don't really know what it is. This spurs from, we go to June of 1972, and there's a break-in at the Democratic National Committee headquarters in the Watergate Hotel, and five burglars are caught and they are arrested. Bernard Barker, Virgilio Gonzalez, Eugenio Martinez, James McCord Jr., and Frank Sturgis. And they all have these various amounts of money on them, mostly in $100 bills. And it's thought to be this kind of just, it's these random burglars breaking in. And then it's funny because we get the scene in the movie of Bob Woodward's character being called in the middle of the night. And this is seen as like, this story is like beneath me, that I'm trying to move up the food chain. And here I'm getting stuck with another, local political, not even a political story, like just another a break-in story that's just going to be thrown to the back of the local section of the paper.
Yeah. And it's interesting because there's that, and there's also the fact that we'll soon get to his relationship with his the man who's always going to be tied with, Carl Bernstein. The two of them don't get on at all, and they're very different characters. But perhaps you had in mind to get to that. But yes, initially this burglary seems like nothing much, a whole lot of nothing. Some rather amateurish, they're caught. They've got notebooks with names in it. They've got cash on them. They've got listening devices.
Address books with initials in it that directly tie to. So they have initials in one of the address books. One is WH, which is short for White House. They have one for Howard Hunt, who is this kind of operative that has been hired as well by this committee that we'll get into. But I think Deep Throat, who is one of the central characters of this whole thing, he is Bob Woodward's source within the government that is on deep background. And you would get the scenes in the movie of them meeting in this secluded parking lot late at night with this incredible coded system of when Bob Woodward would want to speak with him. And Deep Throat says one of my favorite lines, these are not bright people. Let's remember this. Just because this is attached to the government, it does not mean that they have all their bases covered. These are not the brightest of people, and they have led breadcrumbs from this innocuous break-in that would ultimately lead a pathway all the way to the top of the U.S. government.
Yeah, and all of that, for people who've seen the film and are wondering, is completely accurate. Even the quotation is correct. That is what Deep Throat said. One little note. Some of these guys, four of the arrestees, were from Miami, and the initial attempt was to kind of link them to anti-Castro, Cuban Americans who were anti-Castro. And that was kind of the narrative that was beginning to be pushed at the beginning. But it became rather clear when particularly one of them named McCord had very strong ties, to the establishment, particularly as he was an ex-CIA man.
Yeah, and just to go through the chronology of, you know, the presidency at this point, you know, John F. Kennedy is assassinated in 1963. He's succeeded by Lyndon Johnson, and then Nixon is elected in 1968. So by the time we're talking about June of 1972, this is months before the election where he is running up against the Democratic candidate, George McGovern, which would sort of Watergate is at least in the headlines, but it's not a significant factor in the 1972 election. But it would be ultimately the story that the Washington Post would attach itself to in a big way. And you get the perspective of different people in the newsroom that are, first of all, Woodward and Bernstein today, you hear of these two journalists and they're spoken about with such reverence, but these two are 29 and 28 at the time. They are not established. Woodward is very new to this. So they have not had any big stories to their bylines. And this is the Washington Post putting its credibility in these two relatively young reporters and a story that is not getting widespread coverage from a lot of the other national papers. And it's sort of the Washington Post is putting its neck out here, covering this Watergate story and a potentially very damaging story if this does not end up being accurate. But they do ultimately stick with Woodward and Bernstein, but with a lot of hesitancy along the way that you see voiced by Ben Bradley, who is the editor-in-chief at the Washington Post. And that's a big part of this too, is the Washington Post staying behind these guys.
Very much so. I think Woodward had only been at the Post for 9 months or something like that, certainly less than a year. And just to go back to something I'd said earlier on, these are very different characters. Bob Woodward, a Yale graduate, somewhat of a blue blood in that, you know.
A Republican.
A registered Republican.
Yeah, we have a Republican and a Democrat here in Woodward and Bernstein as well.
Yeah, an ex-military man or Navy man. And Carl Bernstein, long-haired, bit more college dropout, left-leaning, a bit less straight-laced, you know, and the two of them are a bit of like oil and water at the beginning, and they don't particularly like or trust each other, which is hilarious, you know. Woodward's afraid of Bernstein stealing his stories. He had a reputation in the newsroom for stealing bylines from other reporters who had, you know, got the lead in the first place. So the dynamic between the two of them is very interesting. I will say one thing about the book. I think it had to be written in this way. It's written in the third person. Mm-hmm. It's written by Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward, but it's written as though by a third person. So it's, you know, Bob Woodward received a phone call, you know, is how we start. I think in the beginning Bob Woodward had drafted the first chapter in a first person sort of way, and we're like, we did this, I did that, and it just didn't work. So it's to the book's, I think it's to the book's, benefit, because it reads like a detective story. It reads like a novel.
Which it does tell you just the incredible note taking in real time that these two were taking part in. And it's just such a different world today, where obviously you can, this is just shorthand that they're taking, and it's of like the highest of national security that you have to be absolutely positive that you are, just that all these details are accurate. And that's, you know, the basis of this book between these two and the notes they're taking and what is laid out in such excruciating detail in the book.
For sure. John, you're a man who's renowned for your memory. And I thought of you at one point where, not to jump all around the place, but I am jumping all around the place. There's a part of the story where Bob Woodward is trying to get the details of, and this is slightly shady, actually, it has to be said, and they admit this, trying to get the details of who is on the grand jury investigating the first prosecution in this case, which is of the burglary. Mm-hmm. And he goes to the court in question to look through the records, and there's a clerk watching him, and he has to, I forget how many people are on the grand jury, but it's possibly upwards of 20. And he sort of has the cards out, their addresses, their phone numbers. And he's not allowed to take notes because he's being watched. He goes to the bathroom to write all of this down and then go back. And then he does another five or so. And it just reminded me of the days when we all had to have a slightly better working memory than we do these days. You know,
oh yeah.
Before mobile phones, you certainly had to hold at least, you know, maybe 10 phone numbers of your friends and family in your head, you know, things like that. These days,
like how many phone numbers do you probably have ingrained in your head? I probably have 3.
Same. Yeah. And most of them are linked to me. Like my childhood phone number before we moved house is one that, you know, I'll never forget. My mum's mobile number. I do know it. Maybe a couple more, but that's it compared to the days when, you know, you just had to memorize everybody's numbers.
Yeah. Bob Woodward also mentions a skill he developed of being able to read upside down so that when he was in offices or whatever with people, like they would have their notes on their desk and would be able to read upside down. And again, like retain it to memory as well. Like it's like it is a different world in terms of like the skill set and what you're kind of utilizing as your tools in without the obvious like non-digital landscape that they're reporting in.
I saw a YouTube video of a cache, like a treasure trove of some of the Woodward and Bernstein notes that are kept in I believe it's in Texas in a university over there. And they're incredible. Like some of them are just train of thought, sort of mind map stuff almost. It's scrawled into the corners. It's all over the place, but clearly worked for them. I mean, you think these days, of course, all you do is get your phone out and press record.
There's a quote in the book, gradually Bernstein's and Woodward's distrust and suspicions diminished, that being of each other. They realized the advantages of working together, particularly because their temperaments were so dissimilar. The breadth of the story, the inherent risks, and the need for caution all argued for at least two reporters working on it. And these two, it's, you know, even in the movie, like this kind of distrust of each other, it's very limited to just a couple of minutes before suddenly they're just, you know, attached at the hip. But it does feel like that's kind of how it played out. And they had their code. Like if either one of them was not comfortable with a story, it doesn't move forward. Neither of them had the power to override the other. So, I mean, you go through a story like this, you're obviously going to have an enormous amount of trust in the person that you're working with because it's your name that is attached to this, much less the institution that you're working for in the Washington Post. And we are talking about a story that you ultimately just cannot get wrong in their positions. And they even talk about this later when they do semi slip up on something, and that if they had proven to be incorrect, they were ready to resign from the paper and probably would have had to.
Yeah. I think it's a really interesting part of how the working relationship developed, and part of the whole process of their reporting right through the chain of command. And on occasions, some stories, not necessarily particularly major ones, did get held because the other partner wasn't particularly comfortable until perhaps they'd got a better attribution or another source to confirm.
Yes.
And then it would go to, eventually, they were working directly to the executive editor, Ben Bradley, played brilliantly in the film. He won, the actor whose name escapes me, won the Oscar that year for best supporting actor. But initially it was also, they were championed by the Metropolitan editor, a guy called Harry Rosenfeld, who fought to keep it with the Metro staff and, you know, pushing Woodward and Bernstein forward. And there was also, Howard Simons, the managing editor, going all the way to the top, Catherine Graham, the publisher of the paper, who was in a very nasty way, kind of sort of in a secondhand way, threatened that she would get her tit caught in the ringer by one of the president's men.
This is one of the best scenes of the whole story is Carl Bernstein calling up John Mitchell, who was the former attorney general and was running Nixon's campaign. And they we should backtrack a bit. We will get to this scene, but this is sort of connecting everything here. I've got in the side of my head, I'm trying to remember like people that maybe like are just not knowing all the details of this, but bear with us. One of the keys that first link everything is because like they're operating on a theory here. They've got this address book. There's like some kind of connection here, and a big body within this whole story is this committee that the acronym is more affectionately referred to as CREEP, the Committee for the Re-election of the President for the campaign to re-elect Richard Nixon in 1972. And this is where they are able to draw a connection from the burglars to this committee, and they discover a $25,000 cashier's check that was earmarked for the campaign chest of President Nixon, but was deposited in April of 1972, so this would be 2 months before the break-in, into the bank account of Bernard Barker, who was one of the burglars and arrested on June 17th. And there is their first instance of a check that a donor had made out to the committee that ends up in the bank account of Richard Barker. So they are establishing a trail here that the campaign financed one of the burglars, and now we have documentation to link them together. And now they're working on a bit more solid ground to put the pieces together.
Yeah. And the money being funneled in a particularly shady way through Mexican bank and basically laundered, so that people wouldn't find out about this.
They go on, and the New York Times, basically the Washington Post, is really credited as the leader in this story, but there's a lot of supportive reporting from the New York Times and Time Magazine throughout a lot of this. The New York Times reports that there were 15 calls made by Barker to CREEP, with more than half of them taking place between March and June. And there was an office that was shared by G. Gordon Liddy, who was another central character in all of this, who was working. He was a lawyer that did have a period working in the White House. And for wrestling fans, might remember one of the celebrities at WrestleMania 2 as well. So that's the Watergate connection to professional wrestling. And that might be the only link that we have.
Wow. I wasn't aware of that.
WrestleMania 2 was not the most star-studded when it came to celebrities, with all due respect to Elvira and Ozzy Osbourne that year. So we have now – do you want to explain a little bit about who Howard Hunt was?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because he wasn't a well-known figure. I am conscious that and it hit me while I was reading this book. It reads, like I said earlier, a bit like a detective story, but the key difference between what an author might produce and what these guys produced is a plethora of names. So I'm trying to be conscious about not blasting all of these.
It's a little Game of Thrones territory where it's all these different levels of government and other figures outside of government, but you can simplify it with layers sort of where each get, and the higher you get, the less names, but everything leads to Richard Nixon, essentially, and it's just constructing this pyramid where they're starting at ground zero with the burglars, and you suddenly, it's like these ladders that take you up and up the pyramid throughout the book. And I would say, for as dense as some of this can get, it's written in a really compelling way where I think you're right. It's written like a dramatic mystery, like a thriller, instead of like dense political language.
Yeah, and there is a very handy cast of characters at the start of the book that you really should bend the page over on, because the next time you sort of are in a chapter and you get reference to Magruder or something, you're going, okay, who was he? You know, that kind of thing. But anyway, so Howard Hunt, not a well-known figure, and I think it's Bernstein that makes the first sort of discovery of who this guy is, and he's White House consultant, basically, but at a fairly low level, not someone who would have been a well-known figure at all. And he's I think ex-CIA person.
James McCord Jr. is the one that he is one of the five burglars, and they find out he had worked in the CIA previously, and that is what first gets kind of the attention of Bob Woodward. What is this lowly burglar having a connection to the CIA? Like, that is pretty that's pretty astounding right there, that you have some CIA, at least someone that previously was involved at the CIA. You are right. Howard Hunt did work at the CIA from 1949 to 1970 before becoming a consultant at the White House. So there you have that CIA connection as well. So to break this down, this committee, CREEP, that we'll just continue to call it, they discovered that there was this slush fund that consisted of just cash donations from various donors. And suddenly they are able to establish that there's money coming out of this fund that is going towards this, not just the burglars, but sort of this network that's been put together to go out and essentially do a lot of the dirty work that some existing campaigns, and it's sort of how far you go up to the line of what you can get away with and what is over the line that is implicitly illegal. And the big drama is Bernstein and Woodward trying to learn who had access to this fund. How far does this go up? And you're dealing with grand jury investigations and people that have connections to the White House. And this one key individual, Hugh Sloan, who worked at the White House, had knowledge of who had access to this fund. And it was someone who just out of it was a lot of the urging of his wife that this was getting very dirty. You have to get yourself out of this situation. And it was a crisis of conscience that Hugh Sloan was not only willing to speak to the grand jury and name names, but he was also willing to speak with Woodward and Bernstein to a point. He was not going to reveal more than he was comfortable with. And it leads to Bernstein and Woodward having to deduce who he's trying to refer to, and almost like speaking in riddles to try and figure out who these five people are.
Yeah, almost a sort of guessing game system would emerge between them when they're talking about the money. Higher than this amount, lower than that amount, you know, and stay silent if, you know, this sort of thing. But Hugh Sloan, I think, emerges as one of the heroes of the story, really, as a man of integrity who worked for as treasurer for the committee for the re-election of Nixon, but as John said, resigned, and seemed to have the weight of the world on his shoulders. They describe in the book in detail that the number of times they visit him, he seems to have lost weight every time. His wife's heavily pregnant. They feel it's sort of hinted at the very least a slight sense of guilt as to badgering this guy all the time, because
they literally knock on his door the day his baby is born. And we just got two questions for you. I mean, like, to be an investigative reporter is to be able to have to be an asshole. Like, yeah, there is that degree. You have to persist at an uncomfortable level to push these people into answering you. And ultimately, a lot of these subjects, their only incentive to speak to you is because it is the right thing and it's important that this information be known to the public at large. And I think that that's something that is diminishing greatly in terms of political figures that feel that duty to the public.
And it would transpire that Sloan knew that the White House chief of staff was one of the five people that we talked about earlier on who had, you know, knowledge and some control over this slush fund for dirty tricks, a man named Haldeman. This would get them into a little bit of trouble at one point where John alluded to earlier on that he almost resigned over, but it was really a procedural point.
Yeah, let's talk about this point.
He was one of the five. There's this, just the attribution part of it is really the issue.
Like, this is the full, like, drama that makes this such a compelling film on top of a book, is that this is the part where this is like your third act, where there is the conflict and where Bernstein and Woodward are looking like they have messed up in a big way. So at this point, they have learned that John Mitchell, Maurice Stans, and Jeb Magruder, who are all government officials, were three of the five that had control of this slush fund that they got multiple sources on. Bernstein then contacts John Mitchell, who, again, a former attorney general running Nixon's campaign. He calls him late at night at 11:30, and it's a memorable call highlighted by the Lord's name being invoked by one John Mitchell.
sir. This is Carl Bernstein of the Washington Post, and I'm sorry to disturb you at this hour. Tomorrow we're running a story and in the paper, and we just think that you should have a chance to comment on it.
Well, what does it say?
John N. Mitchell, while serving as United States Attorney General, personally controlled a secret cash fund that was used to gather information about the Democrats, according to sources involved in the Watergate investigation. Beginning in the spring of 1971, almost a year before he left the Justice Department to become President Nixon's campaign manager, on March 1, Mitchell personally approved withdrawals from the fund.
All that crap! You putting it in the paper?
Well,
look, it's all been denied. You tell your publisher, tell Katie Graves you're going to get a tit caught in a big ring if that's published. Good Christ, that's the most sickening thing I ever heard.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to aero hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.